Now, that Starship was really something, because when you take off, here you got these two turboprop engines in this relatively small light airplane, and the canard's out front. And you take off, you get the gear up, and I'll tell you what, it was the neatest feeling in the world. That canard was up there, and when it started sweeping back, you thought, wow, man, I'm going to be in orbit. And then it would disappear.
You know what that feels like, Robert?
And you feel that you're right on the leading edge of a rocket going. And that was a great airplane to fly. I really loved it.
I am proud to say that it's one of the best airplanes Beechcraft ever built. One of the things you've got to say... someday I'm going to write in my book a chapter about that story. And it's going to be really interesting reading, because I'm going to tell the inside story of what actually happened. I put that in because Mike here looks like a teenager. Next slide. Oh, our prototype, very easy, is in the Air and Space Museum. The one that flew in here 40 years ago is in the EAA Museum. Oh, by 1981, NASA noticed the very easy. And they put a full-scale very easy in their wind tunnel at Langley and tested it. Flash the next slide and then go back. Okay, go back. Go back. Go back. Thank you. Okay, let's finish, because I wanted that to be kind of a closer. Let's do talk about Voyager.
Okay.
Yeah. Where did the idea come from? Where did you first write down or say, this is the idea? Where did the idea come from?
I told this story this morning at 10 o'clock in the home builder's tent. It's really hard when you've been an Air Force officer, hero, shot down over North Vietnam, and then later ran a maintenance squadron with 100 people working for you. It's really hard to come back and work for your brother who's 5 years younger. And I've got to credit Dick. That took a lot of guts to even try that. I have to say, from my viewpoint, that it did catch up with us. I had to, a couple of times, told Dick, no, you can't fly my airplane if you're going to do that. That you can't take it down that Kern River Canyon, and if the engine hiccuped, it would kill you and ruin my airplane. But it's really hard. It was hard on Dick, and I understand totally why, for his younger brother to say, no, you can't fly my airplane that way. Okay? But for a number of reasons, maybe, I'll let Dick tell you the reasons, but he decided to quit and not be an employee of RAF. And go do something else. And he said, Dick, Bert, I'm going to take you to the best restaurant in Mojave, and I want to ask you to do something for me. And the best restaurant in Mojave was called the Overpass. It was a restaurant that we'd go in there and tell the proprietor, feed us whatever you think is good. And there's no menu. And we'd go down there and eat that wonderful, what was it?
Teriyaki.
Teriyaki stuff, whatever. But anyway, Dick and a friend of his shared something with me. And that is, I said, Bert, we're going to do what you do. We want to develop a home-built airplane and maybe make kits of it. And we want you to design an aerobatic airplane for us. And now I'm shaking my head. You know, I really want to make amends with my brother, but I had made a focused, serious decision at RAF, even though we did 15 airplanes, that we would never do an aerobatic airplane and sell it to the home builders. And the reason was clear, is that product liability was always a big worry for us. And the accident record on aerobatic airplanes is horrible compared to airplanes that are not aerobatic. And I had made the decision several times that RAF is never going to put out an aerobatic airplane. And now I got my brother coming to me and saying, design one for me, and you're going to be just as much at risk as you're the designer. And I'm thinking, how am I going to tell him no? I won't do that. And I found a way to tell him no. And that was, I said, Dick, that would be boring. Why don't you why don't you try to do something historic? Because I think I can design an airplane that'll take off at Mojave and fly around the world and land at Mojave, and it would go twice as far as the absolute distance record, which was set earlier by a B-52. Non-refueled around the world. It would be not just a record, it would be a milestone, and it would be a neat, fun thing for all of us to do. Why don't you do that instead? And I don't remember saying specifically, brother, I am not going to do that for you. I said instead, wouldn't you rather do something that would change the world or change aviation? And he asked, well, what would that look like? So I took a napkin and I made a sketch of it. And I
have you to, had this in your head earlier?
I had sketched it up before. People think that napkin was the first drawing of the Voyager. Actually, it was the first time that I drew something and showed it to Dick and Gina. I think the Air and Space Museum has that napkin now. But anyway, I put that challenge out there, and it was something that I thought would be much more fun to do with my brother. And to me, it would help my career more to have that feather in the cap if you could do a milestone. Because I was a little bit like my brother. He thinks we're opposites. But I relished in setting records also. And I think you decided on the spot, wow, let's do that.
No, what the significance was, it's just like a lot of stuff you do. Like the Spaceship One, when he told us about that. I said, Bert, we build home-built airplanes. You know, they go 200 knots. You're talking about building an airplane that's going to go Mach 3.5 and go to space? But the Voyager... But when he talked about flying around the world nonstop, non-refueled, I thought, wow, this is going to be a significant thing. It may be the last major milestone in atmospheric flight. An unrefueled flight around the world. And it's the same thing about his vision, about looking way out ahead when most of the people thought there was no fine way it would ever work. And that is, if you think about it, in 1962, a B-52 flew halfway around the world. It was an absolute distance record by any airplane ever to fly, unrefueled, the longest distance record. And guess who paid for that, and guess how many engineers worked on that project? And here we are. We're three people in the high desert of California with some wild designer and a couple of other pilots that think they can fly anything. And he says, Bert, and then it dawned on me, holy bananas, you really think we can do that? And then all of a sudden, it was just like something that grabbed you. And had I known it was going to take 5.5 years out of my life, and of course you said, hey, Dick, why don't you go and do this other thing? It'll take you about 18 months, and then you can go on with something more important in your life.
I lied to you. I told you that I thought I could do it.
You
and
thought?
You know, he showed up over that next 2 years with a bunch of rich people, and he's wanting them to pay for it. And I expected that they would come up with their experts, and they would come in and say to Bert, before we spend money with your brother, we want you to prove that you can do this. And I have to admit, they never showed up. Not once did anybody ask me if I could do this and to prove it. And I got to admit also, I didn't have very much proof at all. It was very iffy as to whether it was possible.
Most of the people that we talked to about funding it got stopped way before they ever got to that phase. And it was the corporate lawyer that would point out to American Express about our logo, national television, end of runway, and a fireball, and that was the end of the whole thing.
Or their logo on the tail when it was sinking into the ocean.
Yeah, well, Ross Perot, most of the really rich people would just pawn us off to somebody else, and for a while, Gene and I would say, oh, you think that your friend would do it? Oh, we'll run over here, and he would say, no, it's somebody else. Before we spent all of our savings in about 18 months, we didn't have any money, and we finally realized, wait a minute, these people are just messing with us. And the only single person of any kind of wealth that was willing to even consider funding this thing was Ross Perot. And we got a 20-minute meeting with him in Dallas, and Gene and I walked out there and showed this, and he was genuinely interested. And we spent about 3 hours with him. And then he asked a few questions and go by and give me this information, and I will give you an answer within 10 days. Well, we went back, gave him the information, and he's a total gentleman. He didn't pawn us off on anybody else. He's one of the most straight up the ethical person I'd ever met in that category of wealth. And he says, nope, I'm sorry, Dick, but I can't do it. And he was, and I love that. He didn't pawn us off into somebody else. And then the reason he gave was kind of interesting. You know, we were from California, and Gina was my girlfriend, and he was, I think he ran the educational system in the Bible Belt of Texas, and he says that I'd have a lot of problems because you and Gina are not married. You know, at least he said no. And what really happened after that, after we were chasing all these big buck outfits, we finally went to a little place in El Monte Club with a bunch of really neat guys that fly airplanes. A little room, people that fly airplanes, not of any kind of wealth or anything. And we sat down and we told them what we were going to do, and somebody gave us a little donation, and then they bought our posters. And so Gene and I would go around giving talks to anybody that listened to us, and we'd sell posters. And a lot of times we put the posters out back, or when you come in, a little table there, and we'd go up and give our talk. And then by the time the talk was over, the people would leave, and they thought the posters were free. And by the time we got back there, we had no more posters. But we finally realized that it wasn't going to be a wealthy guy that was going to do this. This is going to be funded by volunteers, by the heart and soul of the people that are sitting right in this audience today. And that's exactly how this was done. It had no big wealth at all. In fact, I was offered $2.2 million. I told you this before, $2.2 million. And in early in the 1980s, that was a lot of money. And we were so destitute, I couldn't even afford to replace some worn-out tennis shoes. And we lived in an area of Mojave that the level of affluence was how many cars on cinder blocks in the front and barking dogs in the backyard. But Gene and I, we really didn't care. We're off on this really grand adventure, and none of that made any difference to us. And the guy come up to me and he says, Dick, I can get you $2.2 million for a sponsorship. And I looked at him that morning and I said, sir, your whole industry does not have enough money for me to put a cigarette on the side of that airplane. And now,